You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, all things kimchi. Chef Sohee Kim from INSA and the Good Fork in Brooklyn sits down with associate editor Emil Stonick to talk about how you can ferment pretty much anything. And then Andrew Knowlton talks to Ashley Christensen, chef of Pools Diner in Raleigh, North Carolina, and like six other restaurants, about her new cookbook, Pools, and what she's got going on. So let's do this. Here's Emil and Sohee Kim.
Well, thanks for coming in to talk about kimchi.
Thanks for having me. This is super fun.
So I guess, you know, to me, the first thing I wanted to talk about is, you know, the way that kimchi has kind of like infiltrated our culture and is not this kind of niche-y, right, like exclusively Korean thing at this point. And I was wondering, you know, like now I feel like it's something I see everywhere. And I was wondering how kimchi in culture is different from it was, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago.
Right. I agree. I've noticed that over the past 10 years. You know, my gauge for sort of kimchi and its rise to popular culture sort of starts with when I opened the first restaurant, The Good Fork, just a neighborhood bistro. And I wanted the menu to be a little bit globe-trotting.
Right.
And I put kimchi on the menu. But I wasn't sure how it was going to be received, so I sort of, you know, put it in, incorporated into a dish called steak and eggs. And so what I did was I took my, you know, homemade kimchi and I folded it into rice, and then that sort of served as a bed for this delicious. So, you know, I couldn't, like, outright say, okay, here's a bowl of, you know, fermented cabbage, you know, enjoy and just have it on the side.
But because people were familiar with steak and
that's
eggs.
Right. So, and then of course, you know, so it became sort of a signature dish and people really loved it. And then like a couple of years later, you know, we noticed that a lot of people were requesting it, you know, as a side on the side. And also, you know, when we would go out, just all these, you know, Korean taco trucks, you know, with bulgogi taco and, you know, chopped up kimchi slaw. Like, it really, and now you can find it at Whole Foods, you know, in big vats. You know, I've been trying to perfect this one particular, the kimchi recipe, which is the Napa cabbage. And that's been a very fun journey. In the beginning, I used to fly out my mom, who lives in California, and make kimchi like two, three times, you know, like the old fashioned way and like make big old vats of it, you know, and, and it would last like, you know, for the whole season.
So you were just alluding to having kind of a master kimchi, like a base kimchi, which I think is kind of the kimchi that most people are familiar with and have seen in other places. So like, will you describe that kimchi a little bit to us?
Sure. So I guess historically, it's, you know, just like a lot of other cultures, it's a preservation method, right? So in the fall, Korea is four seasons. And, you know, just like here in the fall, you just get a bumper crop of things. And you want to preserve it through the cold, you know, cold times, the winter. So it basically, people would gather all of their harvests. I'm going way back now, right? The way it traditionally was done in villages and, you know, households. So they would all put all of their harvests together, and then they would have what's called kimjang. That just means to make kimchi, like a big kimchi party, if you will. So, you know, different women would have different tasks. And the first thing to do is to wash and salt the cabbage. And as you know, Napa cabbage is sort of oblong, and you would quarter it and then salt it. So one, you know, family would be responsible for salting it, right? And another family making the marinade, you know, all that stuff that you slather into it.
You know what I remember from when we were making kimchi together is you were talking about that salting process at the beginning. And I think you, I can't remember what the word was, but it was, I think you were saying to kill
to
it.
To kill, with, that's right. To juginda, which means to kill the cabbage, to get all the life out of it, which means just for it to release its initial moisture so that it becomes limp. And so once you salt it, you know, in the correct way, and that's, you know, with any kimchi, whether it's quick or, you know, the actual cabbage kimchi that we're talking about, I think the most important thing about it is the salting process. And because, you know, that's when you make it into a right sort of consistency of wilting. And also you season it at that point. because a marinade itself is just heat, fire, funk, you know, and other little flavoring stuff that, you know, one household's kimchi recipe differs from another. Some people put apples in for a little touch of sweetness, you know, there's all these hidden secrets. But the gist of it is to make this big vat of kimchi, and you divide it up into these earthenwares, and you know, back in the old days, they would just bury it in the ground. So then what would happen? You seal it tight, you bury it. And then what would happen is just the seasons, you know, it would cool down steadily. The earth, you know, it doesn't freeze over, right? As opposed to the external outside. So no refrigeration is like the best place to keep it. And when you open it up in the spring, and I remember, I have very vivid memories. I you know, was born there. I lived there until I was 10. And I remember many a kimjang sort of, you know, in the spring, tasting this fruit of the labor, and mm-hmm. it's just so funky in the most perfect way. And it's just delicious. But you could eat it throughout the whole, you know, winter season.
Yeah, my girlfriend Lauren, who's her grandmother is Korean, and she grew up in San Diego, and she was describing the way that she would start her kimchi, which terrified her, which was that she would just dump all of the ingredients, like all of the marinated cabbage into a huge black contractor bag and tie it off and leave it outside in the sun for like 24 hours. Like it would just be like baking in the sun on a picnic table. And then after that, she just remembers it like being opened up, and there's just being this like poof
of course
of like yeah. intense yeah. like, because it was just so active
in the
90 degree
heat. Sure. All that lactic acid. Yeah.
Then she would pack it into jars and put it in the refrigerator.
Right.
But it was like that initial jump start was what it needed to get going.
Oh yeah. That's a great,
method.
Dirty. Yeah. Down and dirty in contractor bags.
Yeah, seriously.
Not as pretty, but you know, you get the point. Definitely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So that's kind of what you're describing as kind of the standard Napa cabbage kimchi that is always going to be like, you know, a part of your banchan. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about banchan?
Sure.
And what that is and how integral that is to a meal?
Sure. So you know, the kimchi recipe that we just talked about is pogi kimchi, which means sort of whole kimchi or mm-hmm. quartered kimchi. So all the kimchis, and they're, you know, as we discussed before, like a million versions, right? With every vegetable, any vegetable. That pretty much lays the foundational work for banchan, which is Korean term for side dishes. So a typical Korean meal would have, you know, it depends on how fancy you are or how much time you have to make all these side dishes. But basically, if you have like two or three banchan side dishes comprising of, you know, something kimchi'd, like a, you know, pogi kimchi or, you know, fresh spinach, you know, from the market, and you make like a quick dressing with it called namul. And then, you know, say you have another, say, dried anchovy side dish that you stir fried with sauce and, you know, a little bit of honey. So right there is your foundational meal. And then to that, you just add a steaming bowl of rice and then maybe a little bit of doenjang jjigae, which is a Korean version of miso soup. And that is a meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And that is the simplest Korean meal that you can have. So, you know, of course, when you get into the restaurant world, of course, the banchan is, you know, they rate a restaurant by its side dishes. How many you get, what the variety is, how many meat items you get.
Will they refill it?
Will they refill it?
So that's one of the really exciting things about INSA is that you are, you know, there are a lot of places where you can have Korean barbecue in New York and it's very good. But to me, the thing that really is really exciting about what you guys are doing is really, you know, it is traditional, but the thing that you're doing that is kind of new or exciting or different is just the quality of the ingredients that you're using.
So at INSA, I wanted to offer that traditional funk, that traditional, you know, pogi kimchi, and also a very traditional kimchi that people, Koreans, love. It's called gakdugi, and that is basically radishes, moo radishes that are sort of like daikon, but much bigger. I feel like sweeter, crunchier. We cut that up and you know, salt it, and we make a kimchi with it, and then we let it do its thing, fermented, and it gets really sour and kind of funky and crunchy. It's so great. And then the rest are from the market, from the farmer. And, you know, that stuff is, like you said, we talked about, you know, quick fermentation and quick dressing. So you can definitely, you know, the definition of kimchi, like I explained to you before many months ago, it is very loose. But there's another word called muchim, which sort of means like, what does it mean? It means somebody's going to correct me, I know. But it just means sort of dressed in a way or just kind of tossed together.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was what I loved about the recipe that we ended up, that we worked through together and that we ended up running, was that, you know, we were, during the testing process, we kind of didn't want to stop because we were just having so much fun with so many, you know,
oh, it's good.
Like, we were, you know, it's, we were using carrots and turnips and radishes and cucumbers and just anything that we could find. Like okra, I think we tried. Yeah, and I thought what was really cool about the recipe that we ran too, and this, all, you know, it's like I also am a big fan of the like super funky, like really intense, like, you know, you like open the jar and like everyone in the house is like, what is that?
What is that?
Like that's like my thing. But also I think that, you know, so many of these kind of the alt kimchis that we made, if you're turned off a little bit by like that intense, funky, fizzy quality,
right?
Like this kimchi is a good place to start.
Absolutely. And you know, this is something that dawned on me. I don't think we talked about leafy kimchi. You know, we talked about Napa cabbage and the radishes. But in the summertime, a lot of people ask me about their CSA bags. Uh-huh. And of course you could, you know, kimchi the heck out of a lot of those vegetables, but some parts that people don't quite know what to do with, like say for instance, you know, radish tops and greens, beet tops, you know, and greens. Oh. You could kimchi that for sure using that recipe.
Oh, cool.
So all you have to do is just salt it. Sometimes you could just give it a quick saute, like a kiss of the heat, you know, and approach, you know, with the salt and the marinade, and that you could leave on your counter for a day and then put it in the refrigerator, eat right away.
So now we're kind of like, we've gone down this like will it kimchi rabbit hole. Is there anything that you wouldn't kimchi? Is there or even like maybe not necessarily are there any things that you wouldn't kimchi, but there are any like mistakes that people might be tempted to make, or like,
you know, quite honestly, no. I mean, you know, the top two produce, I've had a lot of this over the weekend actually. You know, now you get fresh corn, right? Sweet summer corn. That obviously I wouldn't necessarily, it's too starchy.
We actually did experiment.
You did?
With that.
How did that come out?
I didn't like it.
Yes. So I can't imagine that it would be very good. So, you know, beautiful summer fresh corn should be eaten right off the cob. And tomatoes, you know, we like to serve that. I like to serve that as banchan at home and elsewhere too.
Fermented
just
tomatoes?
No. So just fresh. So what you're talking about is just dressed, right?
Gotcha.
As you would, you know, just olive oil it or put some vinegar, lemon juice, whatever. But using Korean ingredients, rice wine vinegar, again, maybe a touch of gochujang, which is a paste, a little bit of the pepper flakes, some fun oil that you want to drizzle, and a little bit of Maldon salt. I mean, how good does that taste,
that
right?
Great.
Right? To accompany, to go along with that funky cabbage, you know, right next to it. So I think that you can't really go wrong. But things like corn, yeah, I don't think that, and you already proved that.
Yeah, it doesn't work. Do not try this at home.
Right, but I think almost anything you could totally try kimchiing it for sure.
You were saying so that when before INSA, when with your first restaurant, Good Fork, you were talking about flying your mom to New York to help make the big batches of kimchi that would last you for a while. Does she have like a special recipe, or is that something she gave to you, or was she like not letting you in on that?
Oh,
she would
no.
have to do it herself.
Oh no, yeah, she gave me the recipe, although it was never sort of written down. And so just to tell you, it took me about 10 plus years to perfect, you know, this kimchi that we serve at the Good Fork and also at INSA. And like I said to you, it's an ongoing fun, you know, process. But the sort of the master kimchi recipe is not my mother's recipe. Because, you know, when in the beginning, I kind of didn't know what I was doing, and I wasn't really trusting my gut instinct. And I said, okay, so you're the pro mom, come and show me how. And so she would say, okay, so you take a handful of this and a chunk of that, and then you just kind of have to feel for it, and then, no, that's too much. And, you know, she's old school.
Sure.
And this idea, this is a Korean term called sonmat, which means the taste of the hand. And I've always, you know, when you say, oh, she's a great cook, she, you know, she has really great, her hands taste great. I mean, you know, loosely, silly translated, but it really does translate to taste of the hand, and it's somebody's touch, right? And my mother has always been complimented on her touch of kimchi. So a recipe is similar, but she puts grated apples. And I didn't like the fact that it made some chemical component in there, just like what's in pineapple and some kiwi. It just breaks down the cabbage a little too much. And it makes it just a slight titch mushy, in my opinion. Her kimchi, once is long fermented, so I omit that, and her kimchi does definitely taste different from mine.
Yeah.
Now I have my kimchi identity different from mom's.
Well, it's interesting because the addition of fruit, right, is like, you know, there's a lot of sugar that's being added in at that point, which I think would, it seems like that would also kind of like jumpstart the fermentation process.
Absolutely.
You know, you're like including more sugar for all those organisms to digest. And I wonder if that's like makes it a little mushier.
That's too, absolutely. You know? I think that I found that to be definitely true. In the recipe that we ran, there's a touch of sugar. And so in place of that, you could definitely experiment with, you know, whichever fruit you want to put in there to make it sweet. But yeah, it does absolutely help it to jumpstart. And then, you know, if you don't put fruit or a pinch of sugar in some of these alt kimchis or straight up kimchis, it's a little too strong, sour. So it's a little bit of that, a little bit of the sweet, I think, counterbalances, and it makes for a great kimchi.
So one thing I want to ask you is, I feel like when you tell people that they could, you know, make kimchi at home, that they could ferment it at home, I feel like people are like, some people get freaked out and worried that they're going to hurt themselves, or they're going to like something's going to go wrong and they're going to kill their whole family. I imagine that you don't worry about that too much. And
no.
And if there's anything you could say to put people at ease.
Yes. And I think the fact that you are salting, you know, these vegetables pretty well, and that in and of itself is a preservation method, and it wards off bad bacteria, right? And bad bacteria is what people should be afraid of.
Right.
And I'm afraid of bad bacteria, but the whole art of making kimchi and you know, fermenting foods is to produce all the good bacteria that is good for your body. It's kind of foolproof, you know what I mean? So long as you don't, the whole black garbage bag idea, I wouldn't really go with that as your first step. I wouldn't recommend that technique.
It's 2.0.
Yeah. But actually, I would be scared to do that.
Cool. Yeah. So find our alt kimchi recipe and start kimchiing everything.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sohee, for
coming
out.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great fun. Thank you.
All right. That was Emil and Sohee talking all things kimchi. Right now, we got Andrew Knowlton and Chef Ashley Christensen.
All right, Ashley Christensen, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
James Beard Award winner. How many restaurants do you have now? Seven?
Seven.
That's a lot. but I want to talk about your first restaurant, Pools.
I'm excited to talk about
Which you have a brand new cookbook out. Pools is your baby.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit.
Our firstborn.
Yeah, your firstborn. Tell me a little bit about what it means to you and kind of where you were when you opened it and how far it's come. It's been around for 9 years now.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, the building itself is an old diner from the early 50s.
And this is right downtown in Raleigh.
Right downtown. You know, Pools for me means a lot of things. It's a symbol of things that are a part of community that we like to keep around based on, you know, my landlords are the original family. The family, her father actually built the building. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty special to us. So I think that idea of keeping something alive that helps to define what a place has been and what the things that we want to, you know, commit to keep it to be. So, but for me, it was at a time when I had done what a lot of chefs do and decided, I think I'm ready to open my own place.
Because you'd been at a place just in town.
Yep. It was called Enoteca Vin. Mm-hmm. And it was actually opened by Andrea Rusing, who was the the chef there at the time. And
who now owns Lantern and then has a place at the Durham Hotel.
Lantern and the Durham Hotel, yeah. Yes. So I got to work for her, which was incredible. Mm-hmm. And then she went on to open Lantern. I went on to do some things just to keep learning and had the opportunity to come back as the executive chef there and had a really great time, you know, just the experience of really, I think, you know, from the position of being called a chef to actually become a chef mm-hmm. within that title and to, you know, sort of start the voice or the search for my voice, which I had encounters with, but I wouldn't say that I really became who I would be, which is, you know, which I think a lot of chefs do is to go back and embrace who you are and right. what you connected with that helped you to fall in love with cooking or entertaining in the first place.
And where are you from?
I'm from North Carolina. Okay. I grew up about 90 miles west mm-hmm. of Raleigh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Pools was originally, it was an old diner, right?
Well, it started as a pie shop okay. and then they sort of converted the front area of the building to be a little luncheonette to sort of make, they started to see all these businesses opening up around them. Mm-hmm. And so they decided to start to do what we all love to do, which is feed the people who are there.
Mm-hmm. Was there one thing Raleigh was kind of known for business-wise?
Well, there were a lot, specifically on that block, there were a lot of like tire shops.
And
automotive focused place. So the building that we have actually a little while back have secured next to us was an old tire shop. And there was a tire shop on the other side as well, which is no longer there.
Okay.
So like at the time where I took over the lease there and started to do work to make what we, of course, again, like a lot of people think would be a turnkey project.
Right.
A year later, we opened Pools with some new promises and commitments made.
You had mentioned when you opened Pools that maybe it kind of helped you find your voice culinary wise.
Yeah.
The times I've been there, it's rooted in obviously Southern food, Southern ingredients. But one thing I love about the restaurant is there's always been kind of no nonsense to it. It's very approachable food. It's not trying to make a huge statement, you know?
Right.
And I feel like a lot of times Southern food, this renaissance of Southern food is people feel like they have so much to prove.
Sure.
You know, I don't know if you.
Yeah. So for me walking into that space, it was a place that had been in Raleigh as a few things. And I always loved it. I just felt this, you know, this connection with it. And, mm-hmm. and it's the kind of space that you walk into and you can just feel all the old ghosts. You know, mm-hmm. you know that many things have happened in that space that are a part of your city.
Are there ghosts?
We believe so. We just try and say hi when we come in and have a good night when we leave.
leave a little pie or cake when you leave each night.
That's gone the next morning.
Yeah.
But what I immediately connected with was, you know, there, when you walk in this shotgun building, there are these beautiful two double horseshoe bar there, the counter.
And which in my opinion is the place to sit if
absolutely.
You go to Pools.
Yeah. Well, you know, so many people love to sit at the bar mm-hmm. anywhere that you go. Mm-hmm. But the trouble with sitting at the bar if you're having a conversation with more than one person is that you're constantly leaning and bobbing around to make eye contact. So the horseshoe, I think, is such a beautiful symbol of community and that mm-hmm. you just, not only can you talk to the people you're with, but it's inevitable that people strike up conversations with folks they've never met before
right.
in a really comfortable way. But for me, what we wanted to really carry forward and that I would come to begin to build this natural idea of diners that is comfort. You know, mm-hmm. no matter what part of the country a diner is in, there's this idea that you're going to feel welcome when you sit down. And then I really, because I felt so comfortable myself there and so at home, I really started to turn so much more comfortably to what I grew up with, which was you know, two parents who were incredible cooks who just made you feel comfort all the time. Mm-hmm. And you know, my dad was a big organic gardener and a hobbyist beekeeper, and my mom grew all the flowers and herbs. And together they just always, you know, cooked. Like, my mom was this sort of rooted Southern cook, but at the same time, my dad was this truck driver who they were always having these conversations about, you know, things he saw or, you know, that they were reading about. And, mm-hmm. and there was always like comfort in the food, but also something new and fresh. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that's really been what we focus on.
Were they cooking out of, you know, some of the old food magazines or cookbooks or just from family recipes?
Well, my mother's grandmother taught her how to cook. And then my dad didn't have much, you know, familial history with food. But, you know, they read from the old magazines that I feel like my mom used to keep all the copies of. And they bought a lot of cookbooks, you know, and I do think there was something about the magazines of that time that really opened them up to thinking about things that maybe they hadn't eaten before, right, or that they weren't growing. And so my father, you know, would look at things that he hadn't had before and figure out how to grow them where we were living.
That's cool. There's a reason you are who you are, right?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
So Poole's was the name of the old diner before you took it over.
The Poole family, you know, it started as Poole's Pies, uh-huh, and then became the diner, you know, kind of closer to you know, the last 20 years. Uh-huh.
So the cookbook Poole's, this is your first cookbook, isn't it?
This is my
first one. So why did you do one? Why didn't you do the Ashley Christensen cookbook? Why did you do the Poole's cookbook?
Sure.
Since you have all these restaurants now, you could have made a tome almost, right?
Yeah, and you know, I have a two-book relationship with Ten Speed Press. So I did get to make that decision of what order do I get to tell this story. And I think most cooks want to write a cookbook at some point.
Right.
Maybe not everybody, but I think a lot of folks who, when you're in the position of, you know, restaurants are storytelling. They're like, by way of our plates, we get to represent the history of a space, the future of a city, the amazing people who grow all the food. And I also, I love to write. And, mm-hmm. and again, back to that storytelling. So it was a real gift for me to get to decide, not like, if I only get to write one book, what's it going to be?
Right.
I already knew that you was going to have the opportunity to do two. So I chose Poole's as the first of a series of two books, because I'm extremely grateful to Poole's for what it pulled out of me and my commitment to storytelling in the restaurant and to this idea of believing in what makes us who we are.
Mm-hmm. Chefs used to go, you know, try to go into culinary bookstores or do something, and now chefs do dinners with their friends, basically,
sure,
right? And you're going to the Texas for the first time, you said, which is unbelievable to me that you've never, especially a Southern gal like yourself, and you've never been to Texas.
Yeah, it might have been that we got like busy opening restaurants way too fast.
Too fast,
didn't make it over to Texas. But
California, and you're going all over the country.
Yeah,
to do that.
Going everywhere.
Is there one, is there a recipe in here that was on the original Poole's menu?
Well, so there is a recipe in what we call the bowls section.
The bowls.
There's a recipe we talk early in the book about duck confit, and how I think that's a great example of something that we look at as a workhorse item where you put some good energy into something, and then you learn how to do that as someone who maybe doesn't cook professionally, but then you can utilize it in all these different ways. And so there's a dish that's pretty big in Southern diner called chicken slick. And it's basically—
Chicken slick?
Chicken slick,
what,
yeah.
Is that?
So it's like chicken and dumplings, uh-huh, usually flat noodles. And they're, you know, like a lot of foods of tradition, there are a lot of theories on why it's called what it is,
right,
probably where it came from, all those things. But the dish is made with noodles that are bound with fat from like you would have like some schmaltz, some chicken, okay, drippings. And then, you know, that's part of the ingredient of the noodle. And then you're cooking it with the stewed meat,
okay,
and
just a light dish.
Yeah, just a light dish. Exactly. But, you know, for me, I think about that and I think like rainy day or hard day, or right. you know, just that moment when you sort of need that hug from the dish. But so that's a great example, I think, of the nature of the book, and that you say duck confit and people think a lot of things, but they don't necessarily think chicken and dumplings.
Right. So is the macaroni and cheese recipe in here?
It is. Okay. Yeah.
And if for anyone who hasn't been to Pools, I mean, you probably don't want to sell me to tell people to go down and get macaroni and cheese, but. That's your second home somewhere in California right there is mac and cheese,
there you
right?
go. There you go.
Does everybody order the mac and cheese?
Pretty much 98%? Everybody. Well, you yeah. know, and like we don't look at it and say, oh, I'm so tired of selling right. the
it's
macaroni.
Not, it's not like you, what David Chang saying, I'm done with the buns, right? right? Pork buns.
we realized that the macaroni au gratin is the gateway dish
it's the ticket.
To Pools.
It's your ticket. What makes it so damn good? Butter
again? Well, no, there's no butter, but there's the
there's no butter
there's,
in your
there's the yeah. Original ingredient of butter, which is cream.
Cream, yes.
But you know, I think it's once again something that we talk about from cover to cover in the book. Just the idea of looking at really simple things, like if you read the ingredients, mm-hmm. the first thing you say is, "Well, anybody can make that,"
right,
and
right.
that's true. But to make it for a lot of people. To make it beautifully and consistently, not just anybody can care about it.
We'll come back to the book a little
yeah.
bit, but I have this, an old Bon Appetit magazine
yeah.
from September 2008, which when I was still at the issue.
This is when you and I met.
Yes, yeah. this is when you and I met. But I was looking back at it when I knew you were going to stop by, and it was incredible to see the list of women that we included. It was Melissa Perillo, who still has several restaurants in San Francisco.
Yes.
Kelly Lykin, who has a place out in, I think, Beaver Creek now. Mm. Naomi Pomeroy, who I think has gone on to win a James Beard Award and still has Beast and a few others. Allison Vines Rushing, who's still in New Orleans, correct?
Still in New Orleans. Wrote a beautiful book.
Yes, wrote a great book. Alex Raj from New York, who's got four restaurants and you're doing an event with soon or
yes.
tonight or whatever mm. day that is. And then you. Now we would have done a podcast with all you if it was 2016. But
sure.
how is the state of being a chef, being a cook, and also being a woman in the kitchen changed since you did this interview 8 years ago?
I think the...
Nothing's changed?
No. Well, sure, things have changed. I think the perception has changed a great deal, which mm-hmm. is wonderful. And I look at like this group of women that you selected and... Mm. A, you were right on. Like everybody went into the world and did great things. But I really think that everybody in this photo feels today about their goals and what they knew they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
We all feel the same. And I think at that time, I do believe absolutely the world has changed in some great ways. But I look at this group of people and I think this is a group of women who are all tremendously determined, mm-hmm. and when it came to perception wasn't going to get in the way of what any of these ladies were going to accomplish. So mm-hmm. super proud to be in mm-hmm. on that list. What's nice, I think, is that it's less surprising to people now. Like I don't hear people saying anymore, well, Ashley's in the city and she's doing these things and she's a woman. You
yeah,
know, like
yeah,
the,
yeah.
So that's really refreshing to mm-hmm. all of us.
Has it changed the kind of kitchen culture, you know, in terms
yeah.
of, is it easier? I mean, it just seems, you know, we've got a important election coming up.
We do.
And Bon Appetit's not a political magazine, but
sure.
food is politics and we should talk about this stuff. Is things get said at times that would never get said to a man, you know? Is it something that is just kind of... Oh, sure. You know, female chefs are all over the place. Or when you go into a kitchen, are you accepted, you know, or is it there's still some sort of, you know, something that you feel that, you know, wait a minute, this isn't cool, you know?
I don't see that much.
Yeah.
And I can't really speak from the perspective mm-hmm. of someone who has been challenged more mm-hmm. by the system because mm-hmm. that absolutely happens.
Mm-hmm.
I think I came up at an interesting time in an interesting city
yeah.
In a very interesting state, as we've come to find. One of my favorite pieces of Pools being that it was really the vehicle that got me out into the country cooking
right.
with chefs all over the place. I think meeting so many chefs and having the chance to cook together and mm-hmm. form friendships really also protected me against mm-hmm. that in a lot of ways, because I had this amazing team of friends all over the place who I just never, if there was something that I was going to walk into and be discriminated against for being a woman, I already had too many friends in the game mm-hmm. who would say, are you kidding me?
Yeah,
like that's actually, yeah. that, you know, so I think it's changed a lot. I think I'm a big fan of the element of surprise disappearing when it comes to the success of a woman mm-hmm. in a restaurant or in a kitchen. And I do think it is shocking to, I was watching the news this morning and just the difference in how two candidates are treated, yeah. you know, is really wild.
It's bonkers.
So,
is there anything, you know, earlier from when this picture was taken in 2008 that you know, if you could go back and tell yourself what you know now, would you have said something?
I don't think so. I'm so grateful for the path. And mm-hmm. every time I make a mistake or, you know, I'd never regret it, because mm-hmm. I feel like now if you'd asked me 5 years ago mm-hmm. to fix the things that I might have done, well, I might not be in the position that I am now, which I know feels a little bit like a canned answer, but it's true. You know, mm-hmm. when I look up and outside of success, like my version of how I measure our success I've matured to a place of viewing that by looking at all the incredible people who work with us. Mm-hmm. When you say I own 7 restaurants, well, I may own them, but I don't run 7 restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, I have an incredible team of folks who, aside from keeping things consistent and, you know, sticking to what we view as our, you know, set of standards, mm-hmm. they take it well beyond that. So that's the thing. For any, I look at ways where I might have handled something poorly and like, oh, I wish I hadn't said that way, or right. wish I hadn't done that, or put that on a menu, whatever it might be. And when I look around at the people that I work with every day, I wouldn't change a second right. of it. So
I feel like you've been part of the, a crucial part of this Southern kind of food renaissance and revolution that happened. And you're part of the reason that when you go out to New York, you can get pimento cheese now in New York City. And I have New Yorkers telling me how to make pimento cheese now, and I just roll my eyes and walk away.
I forgot to mention that I actually brought you some pimento cheese.
Oh, you
did?
Wow, that's Southern hospitality. No, but so I think you've been part of, you know, a crucial person in that. And then also, you know, restaurants are such a crucial part of revitalizing neighborhoods. And part of this Southern Renaissance has been, I feel like, the Southern city's been reignited. You know, the Triangle area where you're from, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, but specifically Raleigh, has changed dramatically since you opened Pools.
Sure.
And you're a part of that community. And I have to ask you about, you know, I know North Carolina is a beautiful state. I've been there many times, and it's got amazing people, and the cities are gorgeous, and the sports are pretty cool, too. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening in North Carolina, whether it's protest in Charlotte.
Sure.
Or some of the laws that have been passed recently. And how do you view your role, you know, as being a chef who, you know, people listen to and like? What's your role in that? Do you kind of take a step back, or?
That's a great question, and I really appreciate you asking it. I'm always very careful to put my personal political agenda, you know, to hang it from the sign of any of our restaurants, mm-hmm. because I do think, for all, you know, we employ 265 people. Mm-hmm. I think for the most part, we are fairly like-minded mm-hmm. people who appreciate a lot of the same things and really, on a daily basis at this point, kind of have to go to battle for a lot of the same things. Mm-hmm. That said, I want to go after my goals from the inside. So mm-hmm. I want to welcome folks. I want to create a table where people feel like they can be heard, where mm-hmm. they can have great conversations. And I think if we all just hang it all on the outside and, you know, push back against things that are going on, mm-hmm. then we don't have the opportunity to change minds. Mm-hmm. So historically, I've been pretty, you know, careful about personal political agenda. Mm-hmm. Now, that has all changed as of late when it came to a matter of human rights and equality mm-hmm. for all people. Mm-hmm. And when I look at that and I decide what we're going to speak up about, I consider I'm still considering the 265 people that work with us, because I believe they all deserve the same rights. Mm-hmm. And so something like the bill of the HB2, yeah. One of the big concerning issues for me there was, you know, it was referred to as the bathroom bill, which you may know we chose to convert all of our single occupancy bathrooms to people rooms, which can't imagine a single argument against doing that. We've read some of them, but I think that with everything that's going on right now, our goal is to speak positively and intelligently and to try and make a difference in our community by making sure that people understand the power of their voices and of course, the power of their vote. We were getting letters from folks about the people rooms who we would read them, and it was so clear that so many of them had never been in the restaurant. You know, so, but we just installed in all of our, in all the glass fronts of our restaurants, a, you know, a statement that just says, in our, in whatever the design of that particular shop's name is, don't forget to vote.
In all the restaurants.
In all the restaurants. Yeah, and I think what we can go ahead and plan on are the people who are going to say, I'm so tired of the political agenda of this restaurant. Well, reminding people to vote, you know, that's just how, that's how the arguments seem to work. But we're not standing up and saying, this is wrong, that's wrong. We all know that. We know what's right and wrong. And we've taken a real stand to remind people of the importance of equality. And when I say human rights, I mean everybody. You know?
Well, food brings people together. So if there's one recipe that people do make out of the Pools cookbook, what would be the first one that you would want them to make?
That's a great question. I want them to make them all.
Make them all.
I guess you bring up pimento cheese. I think it's a great example of this idea of just sweating the details. You know, and I think in food, when we take classic things and work to bring a new voice to them, I think that's where we do it, in really caring about, though, of course, you can sub in any of the ingredients for things that other people make, giving people the opportunity to control all those factors. So saying, like, you know, if you roast the peppers yourself, this is the flavor that you can achieve. This is the texture you can achieve. So, you know, I'm content with no one ever cooking out of the book and just reading it, because I think the lessons and the information and the experiences that we share are explained to a detail that it's hard to not take away some experience just from reading it.
So Pools, the cookbook, is out now. Go buy it. Thank you, Ashley Christensen.
Thank you.
But before you go, we have to give you the lightning round questions.
Oh, great.
So you have to give me an answer.
Okay.
You can give me an explanation, but it can't be long.
Okay.
We'll go with what we're talking about. Pimento cheese or boiled peanuts?
Pimento cheese. Needs no
explanation.
Defense, though I love boiled peanuts.
late night grilled cheese or late night tacos?
Gosh, that's tough. I'm going to go tacos.
Tacos. What are you putting in your taco?
I think the reason I'm going to say tacos is because there's so much opportunity for it to be so many things. But I would say, you know, pork is a natural answer where we are, but so great with so many things.
Okay. San Francisco or New York?
New York.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Pancakes or waffles?
Because I tend to sort of be neither on the regular ordering basis, but I would say waffles for you and I's appreciation of the Waffle House. And my mother, before I leave town, when I visit her, she insists that we go to the Waffle House, and she never wants to own the order, but there's always a pecan waffle for the table.
Shrimp or crab?
Shrimp.
Okay. I knew you were going to say that. I think I know the answer to this, but let's do Chick-fil-A. Politics aside, or Waffle House?
Waffle House.
Okay. She didn't pause. How about roasted or braised?
Roasted.
Roasted. Two more. Corn or tomatoes?
Tomatoes.
Tomatoes. And last but not least, which I think I know the answer, olive oil or butter?
Oh,
chefs hate this question.
That's a tough one, because I'm so used to putting olive oil in a pan and then finishing it with butter. Why don't we say butter?
Butter. All right. Ashley Christensen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by Carrie Polis, Emma Wertzman, and Lily Sherman, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Plus, we're now offering online cooking classes with Sir La Table that feature our recipes. Sign up at bonappetit.com/cookingclasses and learn how to make everything from pork chops to molten chocolate cake. Thanks for listening.